My name is Patrick Romero. Today I will be interviewing Ms. Florence Schutz of Falfurrias, Texas for Dr. Hunter and History 2 and History 419, Texas A&I University. Ms. Schutz will first tell us about her personal background, where she came from. Then, being a former teacher, she will tell us about her teaching experiences in the Falfurrias area and the Falfurrias community. She will speak to us about some of the early schools in the area, some of the schools where she taught, and some of her students, and some of her most prominent students. She will tell us about some of her former employers. She will tell us about some of the various school rules that have changed today from what they were some 50 years ago when she began teaching. She will tell us about how the school flower got its name. School flower is the heart's delight. Ms. Schutz will also tell us about her experiences or what she knows about some of the former pioneers in the area, such as the famous Captain Brooks, for whom Brooks County is named after. She will also tell us about Don Pedrito, the healer of Los Olmos. Also, Ms. Schutz will tell us about some of the legends brought down about the healings of Don Pedrito de Jaramillo. She relates one experience of how one man was healed that she has heard quite a bit about. I'd like to thank Ms. Schutz for the interview. Thank you, Ms. Schutz.
Before a county examining board, which would grade the examination, and the county superintendent would decide whether you were worthy of a certificate, you had to have an average grade of 75. Or you could take a state examination at the county board three times a year. I believe that was June, September, and December. And the second grade certificate, was based on elementary subjects, 11 of them, including agriculture. The first grade certificate was high school subjects, and you had to pass six of those in order to get a first grade certificate. And the length of the term of certificate would be, depend somewhat upon your grade. In order to get a permanent certificate, you had to have a grade of 85. And then we could also go to summer school to take the instruction for certificates, and that's what I did the first summer after I was through high school.
I see. Now, did you start your early teaching experience? Did you start this in Falfurrias, or was it in the area in Falfurrias?
In the area. My first year was in Loma Blanca.
Good. Could you tell us a little something about some of your early experiences in the schools?
Well, I went to the Wright School first, and only three pupils showed up. They had to walk 3.5 miles through the sand and risk cattle and coyotes and rattlesnakes. And after 2 months there, I was moved to Loma Blanca. There I had 15 pupils, but I also had some rather exciting experiences. When I got to Loma Blanca, we had no desks. So Petra Perez's father and some of the boys around there hitched up their teams to two wagons, and we went over and got the desks out of the Wright School. We had no sooner gotten back than here comes one of the Wright men with a gun on his hip demanding that those desks be returned. And that's the first time I had a gun pointed at my head. So that was excitement number one. Then I was there 3 months before I took typhoid and had to quit. But shortly before I took typhoid, there was quite a commotion there one night of horsebackers coming in. And of course I just thought it was the neighbors coming in. But the next morning I found out that it was German agents. They were trying to induce the people around here to rise up and kill all of the Anglos. But they wouldn't hurt me because I was a German. I was assured, which wasn't much consolation.
We've been studying this German agent thing in our classes here at ANI, and was it a popular movement? Were the German people really stirred up?
The people of German extraction, let's say, were
okay.
not.
Right.
But they were certainly spied on. And the attempt was to arouse the people of Mexican ancestry to oppose the Germans. Or so-called Germans, I should say, because I never thought of myself as a German until Leopold of Paris came in and said, told me about this meeting the night before and said, well, he said that you wouldn't be harmed because you're a German.
Okay, fine. You've given us a couple of your early school experiences. Are there other schools that you taught in besides
yes.
Loma Blanca?
I taught at number 5 one year. Thought I was going back the next year. Voted the wrong way. Got fired. Taught at Loyola one year, and then the next year I went back to number 5. And that was a farm, Alaska farm. The people out there lived around a square with a schoolhouse in the middle. Most of them had one-room houses. Some had porches on, some didn't. Some had 2 rooms. But among my pupils out there were the Frank children, Mrs. Norville, who taught here until she retired, and Dr. Thelma Frank of Corpus Christi. And the Mora family, I taught all of the Moras but one, and there were 9 boys and 1 girl in that family. So I taught Calista, and I taught Robert Mora, who has been a school board member here, but is no longer living here.
These were local schools?
These were country schools.
Country schools.
There were many country schools in the county at one time, about 20. But not all of them were in operation at one time. I think the most I ever checked on was about 10 or 11. The mid-1930s, I'll say, I began keeping the school records for Captain Brooks because his eyes were getting bad. And it was my job to check the county school records and to keep track of all the books that were issued, make out the annual reports, and I did that until the county schools were all included into the Brooks County Independent School District. The first move in that direction, they took in Encino and Loyola, which was Precinct 1.
Do you have any recollections about any of your former students? Have any of them become prominent citizens within the community here in Falfurrias or in Texas or nationwide?
A lot of school teachers and nurses in this community. Among the teachers is Mrs. Olivia Villarreal, Mrs. Olivia Guerra, and Mrs. Esther Aguayas, Mrs. Helen Norville, who was here until just a few years ago, and then Mrs. Salima Garza, who's a county treasurer, Mr. Calista Mora, who is our county clerk, Mr. Sandy Pena, who is the county commissioner, Sam Byington, and Maria Lerma Trevino, who are storekeepers. And then there the Garcia family, Rubin Garcia family, they're doctors and dentists. So I think my pupils have done very well.
That's wonderful. What about your former, employers? Such as your principals and superintendents. Do you keep in touch, or do you know of their whereabouts or anything about it?
Not especially, but I know who all of them were, if you would like to have that.
Sure.
Going back to 1905, there's some disagreement about who the first teacher was, but I think since there were 3 rooms in that schoolroom, there were probably 3 teachers. At any rate, I have Tempe Lutz and Dagmar Hennison as 2, each one billed as the first teacher here at Falfurrias. And I know that Miss Jenny Cade was a teacher out at Old Falfurrias, or La Mota de Falfurrias, as they called it at that time, because I knew Miss Jenny. Then our first superintendent was Mr. E.C. Evans, who went on to become a college president, I believe, in San Marcos. J.H. Morgan. And then in 1911, H.C. Darden came. And I entered school here in Falfurrias in 1913, so I knew Mr. Darden. And then there was E.L. Tanner, For the next 2 years, I graduated 1915, so I knew him. Some of these others I'm a little bit vague about. There's George Anderson and Noah Cleveland and a man whose name I'm not quite sure of, whether it was Bickley or Brinkley in there. And then when I came in here to teach in 1921, I got in by accident. There was a flood. A flood up the line. And one of the teachers couldn't get here when school started, so I was called in to substitute for her. I'd been out of here. I'd been working with my father in his store. And so I was called to come in and sub for her until the week that she wasn't here. And by that time, they knew they needed another teacher, so that's when I started teaching first grade. Then Mr. E.F. Wright came in 1922, and his son is coming the 4th of July to visit me. He graduated in 1923, and he wants to have a reunion with his former schoolmates. J.T. Ferguson, I've lost complete track of. Mr. Charles DuBose came in the 1930s. Well, he had been a principal under Mr. Ferguson first, and then he was elected to be the superintendent. Then in 1939, H. Lee Clifton came. In 1948, Mr. Strong came as a principal and was elected superintendent in 1950. And now we have the new one, Al Byington.
He's one of your students. Is it the Al Byington?
I don't believe Al was ever my student.
No, it was his father? Or?
No, Sam Byington. That's cousins.
Cousins. I see. Ms. Schutz, how old were you when you started teaching?
17.
17 years old. My answer is a change from what we have now.
You see, you only had to be 16 to get a teacher's certificate. So, I should say I was 18, I'm sorry. I got my certificate when I was 17, but I didn't teach that year. And the next year, of course, I was 18.
Could you tell us some of the ways that some of your students got to class? And did you ever have any problems with them being absent a lot or being late?
Well, let me tell you about my first group. I think that will be a pretty good clue. As to, there was a lot of absenteeism in those days. In fact, until we had free textbooks, not very many of the Latin American children went to school. But in my first year in 1921 here at the Valkyrie System, I had 125 enrolled. The average daily attendance was 54 and 7/10. That tells you anything. And only 17 stayed long enough to get promoted to the second grade. But, of course, they didn't count being promoted from low first to high first as a promotion, but 21 made high first. But at the end of school, I only had 61 still in school. Of course, I had half-day sessions, the high first in the morning, low first in the afternoon. And some of the children were enrolled for less than a month. Others were there less than 3 months. Only 38 came for the entire 9 months. 33 were enrolled for more than 6 months, but less than 8 months. And the average number of days present per pupil was 70 days. So you can see why it took 3 or 4 years for a child to get through the second and first grade sometimes. And I was almost as bad when I started school. I was only 5, and it took me 2 years to get through the first grade. But I didn't have a language problem. But some of my classmates had language problems. They still talk German when they start to school.
I understand most of your students were probably of Mexican-American descent here in Valkyries.
They were. For many years, they were segregated through the either the third or the fourth grade. I don't know. As I say, I took over for this teacher that got delayed by the flood. And in that room that year, I had some Latin American children. But I don't remember. I had third and fourth grade in there, and I don't remember whether it started in the third grade or the fourth grade, but I knew that they were put together in one of those, or maybe both of those grades. But up to that point, they were separated. And I might have 120 in my room, and maybe the other first grade teacher would have 14 or 16. Yet she got paid more than I did.
What were some of the rules back in those days when you, say, the early years when you started teaching? Were they tough rules? Were they stringent?
Rather. We weren't supposed to dance or play cards. At one time, there were no married women employed, and that caused a little problem because once in a while we'd get a divorcee. Was she married or wasn't she? Teachers weren't supposed to leave town over the weekend because they were supposed to teach Sunday school. And as I said, we weren't supposed to dance, but I went to Fremont and danced twice a week most of that time when that rule was on. So these rules were often observed in the breach. Then too, we had during the war when it was so hard to get hose, we had to wear hose to school. And we finally got rid of the no married women rule when one of our unusually good teachers wanted to get married. They had to bend it. Once they bent it, it was gone.
What about the, you hear a lot about how Falfurrias was named. There's something about a school flower. How did Falfurrias get its school flower?
Well, when Mr. Laster, who donated some land for some different school, well, I guess for all the school buildings, in those early days, when he died, they named the Hearts to Light the school flower. Up to that, we had every class that graduated had different flowers.
Just what is the Heart's Delight? Is it a native flower?
That's debatable.
Debatable.
But at any rate, it is a member of the Abronia family. It's a San Verbena type of thing. And whether it was here when Mr. Laster came is hard to say. There are some stories that it came in with the cattle from India. And in 1906, what's that old fellow up there? I can't even think of the name of the place now. At any rate, on the coast, this old fellow had a big ranch up there, and Shanghai Pierce is the name of the man that is reputed to have imported the first frame of cattle, and Mr. Laster probably got his at the same time. And there are stories that the Hastelite seeds might have come in on their hair. And that would be possible, even if they picked them up in Monterey, California, where they landed, because the Hearts to Light grow out there, too.
Mrs. Schutz, I understand there was a dedication to a ghost town here in the area a couple of weeks ago. How much do you know about this ghost town? Why did it become a ghost town?
Well, I lived out there 7 years. It was a development project by some men who I'm sure thought that a railroad was going to go through there. Because in reading back old newspaper clippings, I find mention of a second railroad coming to Falfurrias. And they had surveyed the land as far as Mr. Abrupt's, the right-of-way, as far as Abrupt's land. But this was a railroad built by a German company, and it was getting around time when they were having trouble in Germany, and I'm sure that's the reason it was ever completed. And then during World War I, the tracks and everything was confiscated. But there were many reasons why it didn't become a town. For one thing, they thought the towns would grow out there. And for another thing, a lot of the people who bought were professional people. There were some college professors and school teachers. And they didn't know anything about farming. They thought that all you'd have to do is set out some orange trees or pecan trees and just sit back and let nature take its course. And they found that that wasn't the case. That farming was still a long day's work, 365 days a year. So that contributed as much as anything to the downfall of the lack of a railroad. And then discouragement. But one of the people who came to Floella to retire under her orange tree went back and established Hockaday School for Girls in Dallas, Miss Eli Hockaday. And she took two other people from Floella back with her, Miss Tramp, who had come down with her and shared the farm with her, and Duke Stallings, who was a young boy while they were living here, but went on to become an artist and an art instructor.
I understand there are people still living in the area of Floella, but it's by a different name. Could you close it on the background?
Originally, it was the Loma Blanca Grant, but when the original owner, Francisco Guerra Chapa, died, his heirs evidently weren't interested. It may have been that it was the matter, now that was in 1831, it may have been the matter of changing nationalities, for instance. That was Tamaulipas at that time, part of Mexico. And then after 1848, it became a part of the United States, officially, part of Texas in 1836, they claimed. But at any rate, the heirs sold their holdings, and the Paris family bought 2.5 leagues of 5 leagues in 2 transactions. And then later, one of the Paris bought up small holdings, so he had quite a bit more. But this land is always in the entire grant. It was never partitioned until 1897. And by that time, there were about 27 different owners. And after it was partitioned, Mrs. King bought up about half of the grant. The Paris holdings and a number of other small holdings in there. Well, the Paris is owned about 6,000 acres, something like that, 7,000 acres. And between 1897 and 1901, the Kings had bought up much of the eastern half of it. The Sullivan Ranch bought out the Grant holdings. And then Burton and Danforth bought from Mrs. King in order to develop into a farming community. This was a change of economy now, completely from a ranch economy to a farming economy. It just didn't develop that way. Most of the people that had lived there moved away, a few of the Latin American people of these early settlers who came as early as 1850 remained there. I know Ventura Paris did because he was my neighbor. Julio Reyes had stayed close in the neighborhood and for several years had a little store on the edge of the town side. But the Burton and Danforth development consisted of a plat of the town laid out on the plan of Washington, D.C. and a well in the middle for which the town was named Flow Well. And we had a post office from 1910 to 1923. We had a store about a year. And of course, the Callahans came in expecting this to become a town and built a hotel, ran the store and the post office for a few years. But after Mr. Callahan died, his children scattered. Two of them joined the army. One got married and went to farming. And the daughters became nurses. So that broke up that family. And after we got flooded in 1919, after Hurricane, we were ready to leave too.
I bet.
And that was when most of the people did leave between 1915 and 1919, when most people left. We had a hurricane in 1916 too, which discouraged some people. And Mr. Sanders was one who stayed there the longest. He had a dairy and did very well with it, but his wife's health got bad. He had to leave. And she was the one that had the post office during the last few years, so that was the end of the post office when she moved in 1923. And, of course, the Jones family, you can't speak of Floyd without speaking of the Jones family, although they didn't live in the Alpharetta Ranch, and they didn't live in the Floyd community. They sent their children to that school, so we consider them a part. There were 24 people in that family. That was two cousins. Each one, one had 9 children and a colored girl, which made 12 of his family, and the other one had 10 children. And when they moved out, half the school went. So the school gradually went down to where there was only about a dozen children there. And then they began, as the free textbooks came in, more of the Latin American children began going to school. That began bringing them into the community. And finally, when the old schoolhouse was too small and they needed two teachers, they used the hotel for a while for one classroom, and then built about 1928, they built East Ward, which was just an extension of Florida.
What about,
I think I should tell you, there's about 25 families out there right now.
Right, this is what I was getting at a while ago. I understand there are quite a few people living out there.
But they don't call it Floella. In fact, one the other day told me he'd never heard it called Floella. It's La Parisa to them. Back to the ranch name.
What about, do you have any recollections or any folklore on bandits in the area in your early days, or maybe cattle rustlers, or...
Well, I was scared death of bandits, because after that German agent came there, I didn't know when he was going to bring people into Mexico and bring up and start an uprising, and when I had typhoid fever, I was having nightmares for fear the bandits were going to get me. And then when I was out at number 5, second time I was out there, they got some peafowls without telling me about them, and they were still scared of bandits out there, too. And one night I woke up to this terrible screaming, and I just knew bandits had come in and turned out to be peafowls. There was one occasion when bandits came in and stole some horses, and as a result, one was shot through my head and died. But I had no direct connection with bandits. Of course, during the bootleg days, there was an awful lot of bootlegging went through here, and at that time, I think Los Alamos community was sort of a hideout for some of the bootleggers.
You know, you hear also a lot about the healer of Los Alamos out here, Don Pedrito. Did you ever
hear stories that are folklore that really fascinates you?
It certainly does. And when we dedicated that marker to him last year, there was a man from Corpus Christi, an Anglo, that came up to my sister-in-law and said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "I'm here because my sister-in-law is a film at state." And he said, "Well, I'm here because Don Pedrito healed me." And he said that he had some sort of a disease that the doctors told him couldn't be cured. And she said she never saw a worse scarred arm. In fact, the doctors were threatening to take his arms off because of it's a bad condition. And he said his mother urged him to come over to Don Pedrito. So he came, he said he went in and meditated for a while. Then he went down to the creek and washed his arms in that creek water, and what kept him from getting infections would be on me. Went back and meditated a while. And 2 weeks later, his arms were completely cleared up. And when he went to the doctor and showed them to him, the doctor wouldn't believe him. But my sister-in-law said he did carry a lot of scars. Now, there's a story. That's a sort of a first-hand story. And, of course, I've heard a lot of others. You know, we put out a little booklet at the time of the dedication. Have you seen it?
Well, I've seen it, just glanced at it. I haven't had a chance to read it or anything, but
there are a lot of people that don't tell healing.
He seems to have had a very wide popularity, not just in the area, but over Texas and the
even
whole Southwest.
Even in San Antonio, they tried to arrest him for healing, but since he wasn't giving any medicine, the police said they had nothing to arrest him for. But the doctors in San Antonio were quite hostile when he came up there. One man says that he did not use anything except water and eggs and tomatoes and things like that in his healing. But another one says that rattlesnake bit him. And that he doesn't hold